Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, as June is Migraine Awareness Month, we'll be talking about how to manage or move on from migraine, the latest in research, and I'll be speaking to somebody who lives with chronic migraine for over 30 years. You'll also hear from some of the incredible health and wellness stories and people that I met at Bord Bia Bloom last weekend. I absolutely loved it. And of course, I brought my microphone with me and recorded some chats. And the yoga sisters, Emer and Niamh Daly, are back with the latest in health and wellness news. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, all is good with me. I'm trying to mind myself as best I can. I'm a bit like the Buckaroo donkey of late. Does anyone remember that kids' game? You had like a plastic donkey and each player got to place an item on the donkey, and you never really knew what would be the one thing that was one too many, and the donkey would buck and throw everything off and then you're out of the game. Well, that is me. And sometimes it's the heavy saddle that'll do it, but other times it's the teeny tiny plastic rope that is the one that's one too many. So it's important that I keep one's hooves as rooted to the ground as much as possible. And speaking of ground, I've actually been embracing gardening of late. I know there's a real bang of middle-aged off that statement, but look, when the alternative is that bucking donkey, you really have to lean into whatever works and keeps you grounded. And we were really lucky to inherit a really gorgeous garden when we bought our house. So just trying to keep it going. It's not a really manicured or complicated garden, but we're just kind of making sure that, you know, my husband does the grass, I give it a good water, a bit of weeding, and I had a few seedlings to plant and a magnolia tree to make sure we bedded in well. I got 3 sunflower seedlings from my friend Louise as a housewarming, which I have to say is such a thoughtful gift. She just brought them in the little pots and they were just tiny little, you know, stems and 2 green leaves. And I loved minding them on the kitchen windowsill, but they were ready to flee the nest and out they went into a bigger pot. And I've even got one starting to flower. It's big yellow and, you know, they're just going to get taller and taller. And it's such a lovely thing to do. And that's why I think gardening works so well. And you hear so much about how mindful it is, how positive it is, and how we're out in nature. And my auntie Nuala, my favourite auntie, don't tell the others, got me a baby magnolia tree as a housewarming gift when she was over from the UK recently. So special. It's my favourite tree of all time. And it was planted by our gardener friend after living in a pot at the side of our house, probably for a bit too long. And he told us to get organic mulch. That was another long finger job that took several weeks to order online and get. And eventually we spread it out. And that's what I'm saying. Not only do you get the benefit of being outside in nature, but it's that task completion, which I think really does make your soul sing. So that's where I'm at the moment. Also removing the drying brown leaves ready for new growth and watering what I already have, which, come on, it's a metaphor for life, isn't it? You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Niamh and Emer Daly, the yoga sisters, are back. They bring sister yoga events to bring people together and have a love for movement. They share all of their wellness news on their Instagram, which is daily, D-A-L-Y underscore wellbeing. And they're back in studio with the latest in health and wellness news. Ladies, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us back.
It's good to have you. So we're going to start with a story that was in the Irish Times recently, Emer, about girls and ADHD.
Yes, I absolutely loved reading this story. So this story was written by Aideen Kennedy, who is actually an ADHD coach herself. And she had a diagnosis at the age of 32. And she deep dives a little bit into how male and female symptoms of ADHD can show up very differently. So she mentions at the start of the story that when you think of ADHD, you might have thought of a boy in the class who's very hyperactive, can't sit down and can't really concentrate. But when it comes to girls, it's very different how they kind of have ADHD symptoms, and it's all very internalized. So it comes to constant racing thoughts, disorganization, forgetfulness, feeling very overwhelmed and just can't switch off. And the really big theme that is shown with females and ADHD is masking and being able to hide kind of the symptoms that you're feeling. And that's why people aren't really picking up on, like, do I have ADHD or what's going on? And it's not till later in life that they're kind of starting to discover that. And because that masking can go on for so many years, it can start to turn into intense people-pleasing, low self-esteem, anxiety and burnout. And our hormones are really directly related to it as well. So you might feel at the time, the week before your period, those symptoms are feeling a lot worse, especially if you're someone who gets intense PMS or PMDD. You might feel a lot of brain fog, even more disorganized, can't make a decision. And that's kind of when you might take it to your GP and say, I really don't feel myself, like what's going on? And that's when the exploration can start to go a little bit further. So it's really nice that we're seeing this in the story, that girls are kind of starting to look a little bit more into ADHD and what it looks like. But it does just allow us kind of say, what is going on with me? Taking a little bit of a pause and maybe going to your GP at an earlier stage if you do start to feel these things. And like many of the stories here, just taking the time to kind of do a little self-discovery of yourself.
Yeah, last week we had Jackie Mulligan on. She was launching a mental health initiative called The Working Mind. And we were talking about how, you know, you can have like almost a traffic light system of mental health. So you can have a green day one day, and other days it could be a red day that needs a lot of support. And I think that's really positive that we can all have, you know, good days, bad days, challenging chapters, whatever it is. But I think what you're touching on there for women with hormones, that can almost be dangerous, because we have that tough week and then the following week we're okay again, and we kind of forget and we're like, no, do you know what? Actually, maybe I'm grand. Maybe I was just a bit tired and maybe I was a bit stressed and I'm okay again. So it's really important that we start logging these things or writing them down and paying attention to what's happening. Otherwise, you know how quick time goes. 6 months, 8 months passes and then you realise there's a bit of a pattern. And we do have the stereotype that ADHD is that hyperactive boy running around and being, in inverted commas, bold or naughty all of the time. Whereas girls can still be feeling all those feelings, but want to please and want to do well. So they just sit there and try their best to do their work.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the big things that showed up in this story was that, you know, taking the time to just really look at what's going on with you and just really having self-compassion, because most of the time women with ADHD, we are churning up almost putting 10 times more work into just getting out the door some days. And all your friends and family might think, wow, they're really organized, but it's taken so much of their energy to actually just show up.
Yeah, I think it's really important. What about a later in life diagnosis? I think a lot of people at 32, which is still so young, but would think, oh, sure, look, I'm used to who I am now and I've found all my workarounds. What benefit would it be to find out now? But I think the more self-awareness we have and the more we can understand ourselves, the better.
Yeah, I think for someone who has found out later in life, myself, I'm 30. And I think the biggest thing for me was the self-compassion that I gave myself of just saying, you know what, it's okay that you're really overwhelmed. And that's the biggest thing that came from it for me. And there might be many different routes that you go down when you talk to your GP, but that is a really, really nice one to take you through every day.
I love that. And thank you for being comfortable to share your own personal story there. We'll move on to the next one. Niamh, Dolly Parton has opened up about her health, and what a woman into her 80s.
Yeah. So if you follow Dolly Parton on any of her social media sites, she recently was talking about how internally she's struggling at the moment with her health, whereas on the outside, she's gotten all the help in the world and she's very open about that. But she needs to do the work herself on the inside. So I then was reading an article in the Irish Times, and they referenced Dr. Linda Fried, who is one of the world's leading frailty researchers. And it's all about how frailty and aging are two completely different things. So we can prevent becoming frail if we actually work on our aging, which is all very simple. It's down to just working on your body on the inside. So working through your strength, which a lot of people kind of feel is, oh, I have to go to the gym, I have to lift heavy weights, whereas strength is actually doing yoga, doing Pilates. All of this is going to internally aid our body, which means it's going to like work on our muscles, it's going to expand our muscles, we're going to feel stronger, more confident. And then working on that strength is also going to increase our bone density, we're not going to fall over as much, we're going to be more stabilized, which then increases our confidence. So all of this is coming internally, aging, and this is what Dolly is working on now herself. And then as well as that, it's also down to our diet. So we can go to all the classes, we can do all the workouts, but we need to also balance this with diet and what we're eating. So what we're looking at now is trying to get the right amount of protein to hold on to that muscle, so that as we age and we're working through all of these like strength practices, we want to hold on to the muscle that we have here. So aiming to have around like 1 gram of protein for every kilo of body weight that you have. So if you're around 70 kg, you want to be eating almost 70 kg protein a day as well to hold on to that muscle and prevent any frailty or anything like that as we grow older.
Yeah, and I think it depends on your algorithm, but we're starting to talk about exercise in a different way, because up until now, people might have thought, oh, you know, all this muscle bodybuilding is for a particular kind of person, but actually it's for everyone. And now we're talking about, as you're saying, working out so that we can carry in our own shopping, live alone in our 80s, you know, be able to wipe our own bums is something I see all of the time.
Exactly.
Because a fall can really end a life. If somebody falls at 80 and ends up immobile, you know, with the recovery, that can really start a slow decline for their health. So it's very important how we live through our 30s, 40s and 50s determines how we're going to be later in life.
Exactly. Yes, we need to support it now so that we're independent, strong, independent women when we're older.
Yeah, and I hope I have a dose of Dolly in me at that point as well. What an amazing woman. And it does seem like the younger generation, Emer, are getting this idea, and they're really a lot more focused on their health than previous generations would have been.
Yeah, absolutely. I have found a report that says Gen Z and younger millennials are increasingly swapping nights out for gym memberships. So they would rather spend €300 on a gym membership than they would in the bar. And honestly, this is something I am welcoming. So in this report, 70% of Gen Z say that they're more focused on wellness than they were a year ago. And 45% of them say physical health is a major priority for them. 30% are spending more on the gym memberships and classes. And Bank of America collaborated with this report and said they're seeing a lot less people spending money on alcohol and a really big rise in wellness activities. And I think the reason that Gen Z are kind of boosting this is because during COVID, Gen Z were the ones that were taking college remotely. Their first job was remote as well. And they're seeking that connection from people. So they want to start the run clubs. They want to go to the bougie gyms. And it is really, really positive to see that. One of the ladies who was interviewed during the report said that she actually has found her fiance through a run club. And, you know, these initiatives are now becoming, they're replacing what the pub has been. And I think for some generations, they kind of don't want to see that pub culture go. But it is a really positive initiative that we're seeing.
Yeah, 100%. I was hosting a panel over last weekend, and there was a pharmacist on the panel. We were talking about men's health, who has 3 teenage sons. And I was asking her about this change. And she was saying her 17-year-old son, he doesn't drink, and he's very conscious of his macros and his appearance. And I suppose it can be a fine line between this being a positive health situation, as opposed to drinking cans in a field. But then also, there is a danger that we can become a bit too obsessed with, you know, our calories and our macros and how our body looks. And, you know, I suppose that's a dangerous part of social media.
Absolutely. And another thing that came from the report was that Gen Z are very aesthetically motivated. So they want to kind of post that what I eat in a day, or they're motivated by that. And they're motivated by the things that they see on social media as well. So it is very important to find that human connection, go to the run club, have fun. Having fun is such an important part of well-being. And I think we forget that sometimes, and it really is so, so important.
Yeah, I do love to see that. So many of the run clubs, and I know you girls have had a few events like it, where it ends with coffee and a pastry, you know, and that part is just as important as the getting the 5K in or doing the yoga or strength class. And you do see that and feel that. Even the big explosion we've had in Hyrox and Troika and all that, you know, people heading off to Malaga together. It's not just about getting the PB. It's about having that experience as a group and having that community. And while we are working out, Niamh, how much should we be sweating?
Well, let's not get alarmed if we're sweating more in the warmer months. When we sweat, it's not actually a sign of how hard our body is working. Sweating is actually the body's cooling mechanism. So when we're starting to sweat, it's actually our body recognizing, okay, we're overheating, our core temperature is starting to rise, let's take it down a bit. So it doesn't necessarily kind of go on par with how hard you're working or how many calories you're burning. Everybody's different. Everybody's going to sweat different. We have like elite athletes that are going to sweat from the moment they might step out onto a running track or a Hyrox track because their body's so, so used to it. And then we have people that might be more into like their Pilates or reformer who aren't going to sweat as much because our heart rate's not getting as high. So our body's going to react with the type of exercise and the type of sport that we're actually doing. So how much should we sweat? So different for every person out there. What we do need to recognize is that when we sweat, our body's losing fluid and it's losing electrolytes. So we need to replace that. So when you've done a big workout, and especially if it's in the heat, you need to make sure that we're fueling up on that water and that hydration before it, during it, and definitely, definitely after it. So you want to prevent that kind of dehydration. We want to prevent that onset muscle soreness or anything like that. So I guess your sweating is down to how much your body needs to cool down in that moment.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that, because you know the way you see some things, you either read them online or you see them on TV and it'll just stay with you. I remember seeing Oprah Winfrey walking on a treadmill with her trainer and she was like, I just don't sweat. And it just is another indication of the slow metabolism I have. And I was like, oh my God, that's me. That's me too. And I've held that until now. You have healed me, Niamh.
I'm glad.
With this proper information. And I'd nearly look at some of the people that would work out in my gym classes. And, you know, especially men seem to sweat a lot more than women. Yeah. It's kind of dripping off their nose. And I'm nearly jealous of the toxin shedding of them. But no, it's very normal and natural and different for every single person.
Very normal.
Ladies, where can people find out more about you and any events you might have coming up?
Yes, you can follow our Instagram page, daily_wellbeing. And me and Eva are so excited. It's the summer. We've loads of events planned. So come along to any of them if you're in the area.
Well, Eva and Niamh Daly, thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
June is International Migraine and Headache Awareness Month. Migraine is a complex neurological condition which is classified by the WHO as the 7th most disabling disease in the world and the most common neurological condition, affecting about 12 to 15% of people. Migraine affects roughly 1 in 7 people here in Ireland and is 3 times more common in women than men, largely because of the way estrogen rises and falls across the menstrual cycle in pregnancy and through perimenopause. Catherine Hearns has lived with chronic migraine for over 30 years and she joins me on the line now. Catherine, you're very welcome.
Hiya, Claire. Thanks so much for having me on.
And Catherine, some of the facts and stats that I read out in that introduction, do you think people underestimate how disabling a migraine can be and what a debilitating condition it is?
Absolutely. Worldwide, you're looking at a billion people. It is certainly more than a headache. And that's something that I've lived with for the last 28 years. And many people I have come across in, you know, during that time as well. It's a very frustrating condition because there is a lack of education, not only in life itself with people that that you meet on a day-to-day basis, but also in the workforce. It really is misunderstood. I spent 30 years in middle management and I hid my migraine because I used to take days off. I used to take holidays in order to hide the fact that I had this disability. And it is a disability, which in Ireland, it's not deemed to be a disability, but in America, it is. So, yeah, absolutely. It's very misunderstood.
And Catherine, take us back then to when migraines first started for you.
I didn't have a headache until the age of 24. And that was 2 weeks after I gave birth to my second son. And he is now 28. So over the duration of 6 years, my migraine shifted quite a bit from classic migraine to what I was eventually diagnosed 6 years later with. It can be a very lonely place. And those 6 years were very frustrating, not only on me, but for my husband and trying to take care of two young boys as well. And I eventually got diagnosed with a rare subtype called sporadic hemiplegic migraine, which is a bit of a mouthful. But basically to describe it is that it mimics a stroke. So on very severe episodes, I would lose full power on my left side. I would have the full facial droop. I would lose my speech, my swallow. I would have all the other issues and symptoms that come along with migraine, such as nausea, light and sound sensitivity. It's an extremely debilitating condition. Not just my one. I mean, when I'd be chatting to other migraine sufferers and I mention my one and they're like, oh God, mine isn't like that. You know, I'm not as bad as you. But we are all the very same. And it comes with respecting the not just the word migraine, but each and every individual that has it. We are all individually different. We all suffer differently, but generally, at the end of the day, migraine is migraine. So that was how I started.
And when an episode hits like that, Catherine, what do you have to do?
I physically can't walk, so I would have to be linked to basically to my bed. And I'm like, as my husband would say, oh, she's down now for a few days. Which basically means that I'm completely incapable of, even trying to get to the bathroom on my own. It really is somewhat of a mystery. This particular one, I don't know why they call it migraine, to be honest. I have had it, as I've mentioned, for 28 years, to the point where my full left side is completely weakened. And I suppose there's an element of disability there. I don't like really using that word. But I recently actually got diagnosed with low-grade scoliosis on my lower right back because of my gait issues and because my right side, when you're walking or whatever, when you're living your life, it was compensating for my left side. So it has done untold damage to me physically, and not just to me, to my family.
So when that happens, I mean, I'm sure there'll be people again underestimating the situation and think, oh, lovely, 4 days in bed where you can't do anything, sounds like it could be a positive thing for us every now and then. But this is obviously really impacting on your quality of life, your ability to work, to, mind your family, to have social occasions, and you can't decide when it hits and when it doesn't. I'm sure there's been plenty of things that you've had to step away from and miss that you wouldn't have chosen to.
I suppose to go back to your first part of the question, it certainly isn't a fun time. I can guarantee you that. Like I was saying, my speech, my swallow, I'm unable to eat for the few days. Sometimes my husband has literally had to lift my head to give me drinks of water. You're being linked to the bathroom. There's a loss of dignity there. My three adult children have grown up to a point where I had a discussion last week in a migraine conversation with a big company that I work with. And basically, what I realized is like my children have grown up with the trauma of seeing their mother with this condition over 28 years. So they have often seen it start before. Like they would say to me, "Ma'am, you need to, you're getting a migraine," before I would even know it. So there's so many other people impacted, not just me. I've had to leave a family wedding. We struggle to make plans because, there's the worry of me getting an episode. Flights are a disaster for me because I can be guaranteed by the time the plane starts to land that I'm definitely I'm starting to have a migraine. So The only thing is, I suppose, is preparation, is knowing you have to understand your body and really, work on knowing what you can and can't do and the limitations of what you can and can't do. Stress has been a huge driver for my particular migraine, overdoing it. And when I say overdoing it, I would be somebody that would, I've worked in retail, obviously, on the floor for 30 years. So I was on my feet 8, 9, 10 hours a day sometimes. So now those days are gone that I simply cannot do that. So it's very life limiting, and not just for me, but for my loved ones and for people as well around me.
It's so tough, Catherine, and I'm so sorry it's been your experience, and especially for such a long time. What sort of treatment have you received?
Well, I suppose the biggest hurdle, Claire, I had to come over, or I had to deal with first, was actually getting a diagnosis. My particular one, 0.001% of the population have it.
So I've gone through, I suppose, every medication out there. There was one particular medication that did give me an element of life back for about 7 or 8 years. But unfortunately, when your brain is a migraineous brain, you'll get breaks from it every so often. But as life would have it, it's very difficult. I found the gentleman I'm with now, and his name is Martin Rutledge, and he is in the Hermitage. So I work very closely with Martin and have done since I've been going to him over, must be over 10 years now.
I hope you find whatever it is that you can close this chapter, or that it wouldn't impact on your quality of life as much going forward. And it does sound like you're on a good path to that now. And the more we talk about it, the less it'll be underestimated, and the more research can be put in this direction, particularly around women and female health and the connection to our hormones. If people want to find out more information, they can go to migraine.ie. But Catherine Hearns, thank you so much for coming on, and I truly do wish you all the very best.
Claire, thank you so much for having me on today. I so appreciate it. Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, I was at Bordby a Bloom in the Phoenix Park in Dublin last weekend. I'm sure many of you were there too. I hadn't been for years because we're usually away for the bank holiday weekend in June, but Mars Pharmacy hosted the first ever wellness village at the festival, and I was there to give a talk, lead some breathwork and host some panel talks on everything from gut health to men's health, hormonal health and skin and hair health, and I absolutely loved it. I also got to visit some of the amazing show gardens, and here's how I got on.
Robert Moore is my name. I designed the garden for the Marie Keating Foundation called Empowering at Every Step for Bloom 26.
Lovely. And did the idea for what you ended up designing come immediately, or how did the whole process work?
I guess they would have a brief in what they were trying to deliver. They've been in Bloom for 10 years, so I thought it might be nice to kind of sum up maybe 10 years of their time in here and use some of the stuff. I did a garden for them in 23 called Catching Cancer Early, and they've had subsequent campaigns. So we tried to kind of stitch in all of those things within the design, but also they had, I mean, I guess their primary role is in support. So we wanted to do something that was, and in within Ireland, there's five dominant cancers account for 80% of cancers in Ireland. So that's breast, lung, skin, bowel, prostate.
Good for you. So we're going to go in and take a look around the garden. So you wanted to bring people on a bit of a journey.
Yeah, so it's within the landscape. Let's call it the cancer landscape in Ireland, is that you'll see within the garden, you see all these kind of dark, moody tones, which are the charred wood, the Corten steel. There's a dark wooden deck in there. So there's a lot of elements within the garden that are very dark and moody. But the garden is ultimately not meant to be maudlin or moody. It's meant to be uplifting and optimistic. That's just meant to represent how far cancer reaches into our society. I mean, the numbers, the statistics are stark and rather frightening, in that when I looked into it, we all have a 50% chance of catching cancer. I would have thought it was kind of 1 in 5, but it's actually 1 in 2. So we wanted to kind of narrate that and show that, you know, these five main cancers, what people, what support services out there, what they can do to kind of help themselves. Even a kind of a positive living can create a positive outcome. So we're trying to get people to kind of change their lifestyles a bit, get out, live healthier lives, but also to kind of show that if you look at the start of the garden, there's a footprint, there's a single footprint embedded, and that has to do with, that's a diagnosis. So that's even in a communal space, like if you're with your family or with anyone, one thing from talking to the cancer groups, and that's how we kind of, that's how we developed this, like the original design, you know, over a course of a week or two we kind of created this, the overall look. But it was actually in dealing with focus groups and the cancer patients that we developed all the little ideas within the garden. So there's a lot of small things within the garden with really powerful messages. And they're generally, they were all born out of this kind of, call it a collaboration with cancer survivors. So the initial diagnosis is ultimately a very lonely place, because it's all happening in your head, you know, and they're trying to rationalize it, if you can, like something as definitive as a cancer diagnosis. So that's why it's just one single footstep. And as you go through the garden, you see the points at which there's two footsteps, which is kind of someone who's engaged with support services. There's mental, there's physical, there's emotional support. And then at the end of the journey, there's actually two sets of footsteps, because one thing that was struck me is, and from talking to all the survivors, is that they always find friends along the journey. Now, unfortunately, they lose friends along the journey too, but those friendships never end.
Okay, so Robert, you're going to take us in and show us some of the garden. What have some of the people been saying to you about seeing the garden?
I guess there's a lot of messages, though. There's a lot of things within the garden that have been personalized through meetings with focus groups. So people don't get it immediately, but when you kind of explain what the purpose of each thing is, they're small little things with massively powerful reach in terms of, like, they're emotive. It's like a cancer journey is not, it's not an easy thing, from diagnosis through to like a cancer-free lifestyle, which is what they're all hoping for. It's just, it can be a very emotive, it can be a very turbulent, it can be a very, you know, it really is a roller coaster. So it's trying to just do that in a way that ultimately the garden, actually, when you walk through it, you just get a sense of hope and optimism.
So is it really nice after all the planning to see people in it and it to be happening?
I think it's really important. Like I wanted to have this as an open garden, because with some gardens they're all beautiful in here, but one of the things is you kind of feel like you're in a, sometimes you feel like you're in a museum looking at a two-dimensional piece. When you can get into a garden, you can actually get it, dig into the story of it. And with this particular story, you can see with all the, you see the walking, what I was saying earlier about the walking sculpture of all the shoes. So these are the different survival groups. I mean, the reality is that not all of these shoes are from survivors. There are one or two that are no longer with us, so it is quite a visceral thing when you look at it in that way. But at the same time, it's still very optimistic. I mean, overall, like even the nets here at the end, these are suspended tree nets, and they're a kind of a moment of it's a little bit of a refuge, it's a bit of frivolity, it's just about getting away from, you know, maybe the day-to-day stuff, feeling terrible on a day, and just relaxing, just, you know, just not getting drawn into the darkness maybe, and then just allowing yourself just to be present.
I've watched James Kavanagh in his tree net. I've been quite jealous of it.
Okay.
It is a beautiful thing to have in a garden, and whether you're on a cancer journey or not, but I'd say especially on a cancer journey, there are moments of contemplation, there are dark thoughts, there are learnings, you know, that there must be times where you need to just sit and process.
I think people on that sort of journey, they really, it should allow us to kind of go, do you know what, the fragility and the beauty of life, we really should live in the moment. Not as if someone was diagnosed with cancer, but with the sort of, with the foresight they have into that. Like the Survive and Thrive group and the Positive Living group, there's a lot of the survivors within that group, they're stage 4 cancer. And they had said to me that, to understand and to know what it's like, just every day is a blessing. Like there was a lovely lady, Anya, she painted a watercolor of the garden, which we used in one of the early renderings. And she was saying that she was diagnosed in 2017 and told she'd have 2 years. And she says it's 2026. She says I've had 9 years. And she said it's just every day is a gift. And I think if we could kind of just harness just a tiny bit of that.
Well, you've made me do it right now, because I'm very grateful to be standing here in your garden chatting to you at Bloom. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
And Robert and the Marie Keating Garden were awarded gold at the festival, and very well deserved too. Another winner was the Mental Health Commission's Future in Mind Garden, designed by Joe Eustace, and I went to meet him and take in the garden.
I'm Joe Eustace and I'm the designer of the Future in Mind Garden at Bloom 2026.
So that was a hefty project to take on. There was a big responsibility. Did you feel the weight of it?
I suppose absolutely, yeah. Like it's a very poignant subject. I mean, the deinstitutionalisation of mental health. It's I suppose there's a lot of people out there that fell victim to that kind of old flawed system. So you feel that little bit of weight and that, I suppose, responsibility to do right by those people and ensure that they're represented in the space. So I think that we've achieved that, and the public seem to agree, which is that's my job done, which is nice, you know.
And aside from representing that, to be out in nature, to be gardening, to be connecting back with the earth, even your water feature, like these are all ways that we can be mindful in the moment and mind our mental health.
Yeah, I mean, like today with the way that life is, it's so quick, and a garden, it just gives you that arena where you can really just do the thing that you're, I suppose, that's in front of you. You know, whereas when you're driving or if you're always thinking about the next thing that you have to do. Whereas in a garden, your mind is just purely in that space, and it really just allows you to, to calm down and to be mindful, and it affords you that space, which is just putting the pieces together as you find it and trying to do what you can with what you have.
Yeah, I love that. Well, there's real beauty there and all around, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Claire. Cheers.
My name is Declan Watson. I'm an executive director at Myeloma Ireland, and I'm part of the inspiration behind putting this garden together to tell the story of the patient journey for myeloma patients.
So what is myeloma, Declan?
Myeloma is basically a cancer of the blood plasma cells that predominantly live in the bone marrow, where the body produces excessive amount of junk paraproteins that interfere with how much white blood cells and red blood cells you can have. So it crowds out the good stuff, and that tends to lead to common illnesses, to frequently getting sick. It attacks the bones, it attacks the kidneys. And the problem with myeloma mainly is it is such a stealth cancer that how it masks itself in other ailments tends to delay diagnosis for patients, and obviously the longer it takes to diagnose, the less options patients have in terms of treatment, which is not a good thing.
Did you say to me you have myeloma yourself?
I do. I started off with a long runway. I was on getting treatment for something else, and my blood protein spiked, and I had the precursor called MGUS, which is monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance, which sounds incredibly innocuous, right? But 10% of those patients progress to smoldering myeloma, and that sort of, like, now think of it as, yeah, there's smoke, there's no fire yet, but there's smoke. 10% of those patients progress to full-blown myeloma. Now, all along, I thought those odds were pretty darn good, but unfortunately, I progressed reasonably rapidly, but I had time to educate myself and prepare myself for what was going to come. And one of the most helpful things that I researched and the messages I got was, educated myeloma patients live longer. Now think about that. The more you know about the illness, the more informed conversations you can have with your healthcare professionals and figure out what's right for you in terms of treatment. So I'm a huge believer in that. So we've just launched a new website, myeloma.ie, that has a ton of information that really focuses on meeting the patient and their carers where they are, and focuses also on their well-being, because it's not just about understanding the disease, it's how do I take care of myself so I can live my best life and manage through this disease.
And something you really wanted to get across with this garden, this beautiful garden that we're sitting in here now, was that any sort of illness or condition doesn't just impact the person going through it, but there's a network of people, their support system around them, in particular their direct carers.
Very much so. And you know, it's staggering as to how many carers have gone through the garden and have connected with the messaging, because they see the recognition in terms of what they do, and they also see it in the patient that they tend to be caring for. Family members are impacted by this as well, and because they have to give up some of their time in order to support a loved one. And that is difficult, especially when you're trying to support somebody that you love and care about, and you struggle to see them suffer and go through difficult treatment, and you know that there's no cure. The best thing is you can hope for is that you go into remission, and that remission is as long as possible. Unfortunately, myeloma comes back. There is no complete cure for myeloma as of yet, but it is very treatable if caught early, and people can live fairly long, productive lives and, you know, enjoy life and live their life.
Now, so I'm here in the very glamorous surrounds of the Simproof storeroom with the woman of the hour, head of Myers Pharmacy in the first ever wellness village at Bordby Ebloon, Una O'Hagan. What a few days it's been.
It's been incredible, honestly, Claire. It's been phenomenal. We didn't know what to expect because this is our first year, obviously. And it's the first year actually for Bordby Ebloon to do something like this as well. So we're absolutely honoured to partner with them and to bring this to life. You know, we had an idea of, we didn't want just like a stand or a few stands. We really wanted, if we were going to do this, to really educate anybody who was coming to Bordby Ebloon to actually around their health and well-being. As you know, we have this concept called Pharmacy 360 in our business, and even though we're dispensing medicines all of the time, actually we can see whenever people have an integrative approach to their health and a proactive approach, our customers get so much better health outcomes. So Pharmacy 360 really focuses on five pillars of health: their nutrition, their movement, their sleep, their stress management, and the connections that they have, connections to themselves, connections to their family and friends, and connections to the environment. So it was very aligned to really what Bordby Ebloon is all about as well. And so that's why we really were keen to partner with them. And for us, it's all about really educating people around those aspects of health. So we've been it's been brilliant just to bring so many experts really over the 5 days here to share their knowledge with people through our educational talks or doing the health screenings as well, so people can have a better understanding what's driving their health, maybe get some health screening done, know their numbers. And then what I always find is people then are educated, they know what is going on in their own body, Claire, why they might be getting the niggles that they're getting, and they are well equipped then to make the right, I suppose, much more informed decisions about their health. And that's what this has been all about.
And something I really loved to hear was that when Bordby Ebloon were planning, you know, they often ask attendees, what would you like to see more of? And wellness was one of the biggest things that came back. So there really is an appetite. People want to know, how can I live my best life? And, you know, that means so much more than an Instagram picture. That means feeling well in your body and in yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely. So they obviously surveyed out their customers, and because this was their anniversary, they wanted to do something different, and wellness came back as the number one thing, you know. So that just goes to show you, people of Ireland have a real appetite for wellness now. And, you know, Bordby has been really focusing hugely on food, obviously, since it's moved from gardens into food here at this festival. But now there's a real link between food and wellness, because we now know our food that we eat is our medicine, you know. And it was a great quote by Steve Jobs saying, let food be your medicine, otherwise someday medicine will become your food. And it is so, so true. Our nutrition is so important, and we've gone through so many different diets, as you know, Claire. There's so many diets out there, but actually our nutrition is about nourishing our body. It's about putting things in, and I know that you're always saying that as well. It's about looking after our gut health. Once we do that, it helps to reduce inflammation in our body. It helps to protect us against chronic diseases. So I think people have a huge appetite for this in Ireland. They want to know what's going on in their body, and they want to know what they can do about it. But not just when they have a chronic illness, Claire. It's actually, how can I prevent getting something? Because they might have a family history of heart disease or Alzheimer's or something like that, and they want to make sure that that's not their destiny as well.
I really did enjoy it. The people I met, being surrounded by nature, the trees, the walled garden, the stunning show gardens, and an array of food choices, browsing and people watching. I do hope to return to the Wellness Village next year, and thanks to Myers and to Bordby Ebloon for taking such good care of me all weekend. Right, that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. Thanks to all my guests, to my producer, Aoife Breen, to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound, and to Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts. But thanks as ever to you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.